Welcome to the podcast of Grace Covenant Church, where we are transformed by God's grace, connected through relationships, and committed to service.
We sang just a minute ago that we join in all creation singing to the King of Kings. This week we're looking at how creation speaks to us about God's wonder. We're looking in many respects at Romans 1:20. It says, "For since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes or qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that all men are without excuse." So today we're going to look at, you know, how God's revelation, sometimes people will say there's two books of revelation from God. One is the book of nature and the other is the book of the Bible. And today I've brought a friend, Dr. Walter Bradley, is joining us today to speak on the authority of God's revelation in nature. Dr. Bradley got his undergraduate degree and his doctorate at the University of Texas here in Austin. Then he taught around, and then he ended up at Texas A&M University for a number of years. You were chairman of the Department of Mechanical Engineering.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
And now he's at Baylor University, where he's a distinguished professor there teaching, again, mechanical engineering. Is that right?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about yourself, and I'll turn the clicker over to you.
Well, I had seven great years, at University of Texas doing my undergraduate and graduate degrees. I taught in Colorado for 8 years and then taught at Texas A&M for 24 years before going to Baylor in 2002. And one of the reasons that I decided to move from Texas A&M to Baylor was because I wanted to do some very different kinds of research, which we'll be talking about later in the program. I have a lovely wife who will be here at the 10:30 service.
The 11 o'clock service.
11 o'clock service. I hope whatever she'll be. I'm not sure what I told her. She may be here at 10:30. In any case, we have a daughter and a son and seven grandchildren. Our daughter and son-in-law and three of them live here in South Austin. And so it gives us a good excuse to come occasionally. And I should say this is my third opportunity to visit Grace in the last 8 months, so I'm becoming a regular visitor.
Right. Maybe a regular tender around here.
Well, it could be. Well.
So another day.
Fair enough.
Hey, I'm glad Dr. Bradley spoke at the National Seminar of Faith and Science seminar that was hosted here.
So. Yeah. Vibrant Dance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about God's revelation and what you've been able to put together for us. Dr. Bradley's traveled the world. I think we ran into each other. He didn't know that, but in Russia once, speaking on this subject. And when the doors of Russia opened up and the Iron Curtain came down there, they were asking for people to explain things from a biblical point of view, and they brought in some scholars from the United States, and Walter Bradley was one of those.
Yeah, that was actually a terrific opportunity because this is 70 years worth of atheism. They've right. never heard anything but that, and so it was a wonderful opportunity to go and to really ring people's bells in a very different way.
Right.
Who were very sort of complacent in their belief that science supports unilaterally atheism, and to find out that actually it's a fairly poor bet in today's world right. was a big shocker for them. Let me start with the question, is this just an in-house question, or is it one that really people who are also not necessarily people of faith also find of interest? Time magazine in December of 1992 actually ran a cover story called "What Does Science Tell Us About God?" Newsweek ran a similar cover story in 1997, and other magazines have done similar articles since then. And I think what it says is that there are amazing things that have been going on in the field of science over the last 50 years that have changed dramatically the way many people see this, because I think there was the thought at one point that if we study science long enough, through science, we'll study the world long enough, we'll actually ultimately explain everything in terms of natural processes. And we won't render belief in God impossible, simply quite unnecessary. And I think it's been quite surprising to many scientists in the last 50 years to see that expectation has not played out at all. Much of what we're learning in science today actually strengthens the belief in a theistic creator who designed an amazing universe. And there are so many enigmatic things about it. I like to think God's left his fingerprint everywhere. And what we're going to do today is to look at some of those fingerprints. You don't have to be a scientist to appreciate at a certain level the many different things that I think are very clear, compelling evidence for belief in a very carefully crafted universe for our benefit, made by a wonderful, loving Creator God. Uh-huh. Let me make an important disclaimer as we get started on this topic, and that is that you cannot, at the end of the day, scientifically prove or disprove the existence of God. If there is a God, God is a primary cause, and the laws of nature are what we would call secondary causes. And so all we can do then is to ultimately say, what is it about the nature of nature that either suggests it's likely that there must be a creator God, or the universe seems to be relatively well explained in terms of natural processes, and so recourse to appeals to belief in some kind of a God are quite superfluous or unnecessary. So I think that our job today is to understand at the beginning, we do not scientifically prove or disprove the existence of God. I give talks on this subject all over the country, and mainly at universities, not normally in churches. And in the last year, I've been at, for example, Dartmouth and Princeton, giving talks to secular audiences primarily at these schools. But I always tell people in the advertisements, please don't put scientific proof for the existence of God. That will make you and me look very stupid, okay? You can't ultimately scientifically prove.
It's a philosophical question.
Yes.
Not a scientific question. Science has limits, and this question transcends those limits. But what you are going to discuss today are probability issues.
Yes.
We'll be looking at, what, six or so different ways of looking at things that would show that the odds of things getting in order or life from non-life are highly unlikely.
Yes, exactly right.
So, and so this is what we're going to look at today, six examples of relevant discovery. And I want you to know, going into this, or why don't you explain those real quickly, and I'll make a quick comment.
Yeah, the six areas we're going to look at very briefly, Big Bang cosmology, the mathematical form that nature takes, the fine-tuning of the universal constants, the remarkable requirements for the initial conditions, the planet Earth with all of its amazing and unique qualities, very different than almost any place in the universe that we've been able to see, and then the amazing origin of life, if we don't run short of time. Right. We may have to trim this a bit before we get to the end of it. But the point I want to make here is that in every different area of science, we're finding remarkable things that I think point clearly to the existence of a creator God.
Right. Dr. Bradley is going to survey very quickly, running through these 6 points today. And we were talking earlier, even this morning, that he's going to remind some of you some things that you might have learned in high school or college. Some of you, it'll be new information. We have no intention of trying to teach you anything new. We're just trying to put pieces together of some puzzles, right?
Yes, exactly.
So we'll be blazing through these slides.
The things that are more complicated, the people who already have a background will understand, and those who don't worry about it. Yeah. We're just going to keep rolling along. For those of you that are interested in more details, if you'll check with me after the service this morning, I'll be glad to give you a place where you can go and get a very nice book chapter that will discuss essentially all of these in great detail with about 100 references.
Okay, great. Let's go.
Well, let's get
going. Start with Big Bang.
Okay. The steady state theory of the universe was quite popular you can almost go back to the Greeks, this idea that the universe has eternally existed, that it's infinite in expanse, it's infinite in time. And this was really something that atheists, I think, probably particularly favored because it resolved two potential problems for them. It avoided any issue of a first cause. If the universe has eternally existed, then we don't have to worry about how did it get started. It's just always been here. If the universe is infinite in its expanse, then there is so many probability resources that even improbable things become probable in a universe that's infinitely large.
Right. Carl Sagan held to this view.
Precisely. Big Bang cosmology was first proposed in 1929, and it came for a very interesting reason. As astronomers looked in every different direction into the sky, it seemed that the universe was receding. And the question is, how could we possibly be with the universe receding in every direction? Didn't make any sense, because we didn't think the Earth was at the center of the universe. And then a guy came up with a really interesting idea. If I had brought a balloon this morning, a round balloon, I'd put small dots on the balloon, and then I began to blow it up. If you would imagine yourself on any one of those dots, you would see that all the other dots are moving away from you with your place on the surface of the balloon. So the more I blow the balloon up, the more the dots all recede from each other, and this became, I think, the kernel idea in the Big Bang. Now, what's interesting about that is if you imagine the universe as an expanding balloon, then you have to think, well, someplace in the past, it must have been something very small, And in fact, the Big Bang hypothesized exactly that, that the universe came into existence at a time in the past with an inexplicable explosion that first brought energy and it later condensed into matter. And the universe's expansion has continued ever since then with other things happening along the way. Energy and matter were created in this initial explosion. The term Big Bang was actually a derisive term by people who were making fun of the theory. The steady state people were saying, what a stupid idea, a Big Bang beginning to the universe. But today we kind of think of it as, actually it's a pretty good description. They meant it to be ridicule, but it wasn't. But here are the important points. It postulated a universe of finite duration and a universe of finite expanse. This became widely accepted in 1965 with the discovery of the background radiation, which had actually been predicted. If there was a Big Bang, there ought to be an afterglow. And the discovery of that afterglow, which precisely fit what the models had predicted, was compelling evidence. What are the philosophical implications? I think Stephen Hawking, who is a well-known agnostic from Cambridge University in England, in his book A Brief History of Time, put it this way: so long as the universe had a beginning, we could suppose it had a creator. That's exactly why many of the steady-state people didn't want to accept the Big Bang, even though the evidence for it was actually much better. Robert Jastrow in 1977, one of the famous astronomers of that period, founder of the Goddard Space Center, a professor at Columbia University, keynote speaker at this particular conference, and he gave a talk that surprised people. When you're an invited speaker, you can usually talk on whatever you want. He wanted to talk on God and the astronomers. Now, as an agnostic, that was a rather peculiar topic. But he goes through and he shows that evidence for the Big Bang has always been superior to that for steady state, and the resistance to accepting it was philosophical implications. His concluding paragraph in his presentation, which is a wonderful book by the same title, God and the Astronomers, you should get it and read it. It's a 50-minute read because it was a 50-minute talk. Here's what he says. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story of the Big Bang ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. Isn't that a great quote? I would love to have been there to have seen the sort of astonished and maybe irritated look of these people, because this is the most prestigious scientific meeting in the world each year, the annual meeting of the AAAS, and for him to have led it. And then he went on in his book to say, and in the presentation, you know, there's something odd about this whole idea too, because if you look in Genesis 1:3, this old archaic Hebrew writing, the first act of creation was for God to say, let there be light. Now, that sounds innocent enough, but in fact, the Big Bang makes exactly that claim, that the universe began in a fiery explosion of electromagnetic radiation that later condensed into matter. And who would have ever thought that you would say, let's begin with light? Okay, it doesn't make any sense from our kind of common, ordinary experience. So, and he said, that's a kind of an interesting coincidence, but very. In a subsequent interview with Christianity Today, agnostic Dr. Jastrow says, astronomers now find they've painted themselves into a corner because they have proven by their own methods that the world began abruptly in an act of creation to which you can trace every star, every planet, and everything in this cosmos and on the earth. And they have found that this happened as a product of forces they cannot hope to discover. Isn't that a remarkable concession or admission by a very famous scientist who is an agnostic? I might add, Jastrow wanted to debate Carl Sagan because he really didn't like Carl Sagan's program Cosmos, and he felt like it was a bit of a charlatan sham scientifically, and Sagan would never debate him. I mean, we would have been happy to have helped organize that. funny. Okay, so let's summarize the evidence from the Big Bang theory as follows. The scientific evidence overwhelmingly supports Big Bang cosmology, and Big Bang cosmology clearly supports deism or theism as opposed to atheism.
Because there's a beginning, and if there's a beginning, that means there must have been a creator.
Absolutely.
It couldn't have created itself. It's not an uncaused cause. It's actually a cause.
Yep.
So there has to be that. So now the next argument had to do with math and the mathematical principles pointing to some sort of design.
Yeah, this was Matt's favorite point, as I recall, when we were going over this, as you'll see in just a second.
Right.
It's interesting. If you go back to the early giants of the advent of modern science, Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and Newton, interesting, all men of faith, and they wrote admiringly about the orderly mathematical universe that they were beginning to understand. They believed that God had designed the universe, and it was to be expected that all phenomena of nature would follow one master plan. The universe was clearly ordered and thus described by mathematics because God had fashioned it that way. And each of these men wrote very eloquently on that topic. So there was no dispute in the early scientists' minds that the universe is the way it is because a creator made it that way. Should be understood, too, that the orderliness in nature that makes it possible to describe it with mathematics, not the mathematics that makes it orderly. Differential equations don't tell the universe how to behave. The universe behaves the way God ordained it to behave, and it happens that God, in his own sort of clever way, made it all very mathematical in the way we can describe it, much the way a painter might paint it.
This is the slide.
Yeah, here's the one that Matt really liked the best. And he said, let's don't spend too much time on this one.
Dr. Bradley, don't explain this.
This will give Excedrin headache. Now, let me make one simple point. Forget the equations, okay? There's an important point here. These are the five fundamental laws of nature from which almost everything else then builds or unfolds. And what's remarkable is that the universe, in its remarkable diversity and complexity, finds its foundation in five simple mathematical laws that can be written in such elegant simplicity you can put them on one side of one sheet of paper. That does not sound like an accidental universe. It sounds like a universe that's very carefully and tightly designed, where things are intricately interwoven. It is really an amazing, observation. And if you look at these, each one of these describes a characteristic of nature without which, if it wasn't true, if that characteristic didn't exist, the idea of a universe where complex conscious life could develop would simply be dead on arrival.
Right.
Eugene Wigner, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, commented on this very eloquently as people came to fully appreciate this as time passed. By the time we get to the 1960s, this early observation of the modern scientists who began modern science has become, I think, more and more and more evident. And here's what Eugene Wigner says. The enormous usefulness of mathematics is something bordering on the mysterious. There is no rational explanation for it. The miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. Isn't that great? From Nobel Prize-winning physicists. And I think Wigner, from what I've read in other places, understood it as a gift from God himself. Albert Einstein, probably the most famous physicist of all time, made the interesting comment, the most incomprehensible thing about our universe is its comprehensibility. He says, we would have naturally expected a universe of chaos, a universe that's hard to describe, hard to account for, and yet it becomes, as we understand it better, elegant in its mathematical simplicity and form, flowing out of that remarkable diversity and complexity. But Einstein was extraordinarily impressed by this observation that the universe is so comprehensible, and it's very comprehensible because it can be understood in such a neat mathematical way. Well, what does the universe, why does the universe assume this elegant mathematical form? It obviously implies there's a really great mathematician who is at the heart of this, who laid the plans, who designed it, who put it into motion and continues to operate it.
Okay, so we have a big bang. There must be a beginning. Mathematics is showing there must be a mathematician making things get in order. Let's look at universal constants.
Yes.
You'll need to describe what that means.
Okay, universal constants. So what you see on the inside of your physics or chemistry books, things like the speed of light, Planck's constant, Boltzmann's constant, the unit charge, gravity force constant. These are all values that are just observed in nature. We say, why is the speed of light 3 times 10 to the 8 meters per second instead of 2 or 4?
Or why doesn't it fluctuate?
Why is it a constant? Random. And why is it that particular constant? Let's look at a few more here. Okay. So these are examples. There are 19 in total. And originally, I think scientists thought, well, We have this particular set. We don't know why they are what they are, but if we had a bunch more options, you could have different combinations and you'd get a different universe and life would be different in some appropriate way. But one of the remarkable discoveries of the 20th century has been that if you change any of these constants, even just a little bit, it changes in a rather unexpectedly dramatic way the nature of the universe that makes it unsuitable for life of any imaginable type. So it's not that we just have 19 constants. We really need these very fine-tuned values that we actually have.
So a little bit would be like 10, instead of 10 to the 27th, it would be 10 to the 26th.
Correct.
And then nothing exists.
Right. Nothing works. Okay, let's do this. We're running short on time, so I'm going to skip past one illustration here. And let's just see what Arnold Penzias says about this. Arnold Penzias won the Nobel Prize in Physics, interestingly enough, for discovering background radiation for the Big Bang. And here's what he says as he looks at this whole picture. Astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing and delicately balanced, okay, that's the universal constants, to provide exactly the conditions required to support life. In the absence of an absurdly improbable accident, the observations of modern science seem to suggest an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan.
One might say that.
Might say it. Yeah, why not?
Okay, so our next one is initial indicators.
Okay.
Again, yeah. I'll need you to explain a little bit that what that means.
Initial conditions. For those of you who've taken differential equations, which is probably three of you, it's not the usual topic for most people in college. When you solve differential equations, you normally have constants that have to be given assigned values, and then you have boundary conditions. And so we're talking about the initial conditions as in the boundary conditions. Now, here's what it means practically. If the initial Big Bang velocity of the universe as it began to expand were too high, it would have expanded so rapidly there would never have been any condensation into stars and into planets. If it expanded too slowly, it would have expanded and under its own gravity attraction would have recollapsed.
Right.
Now, it turns out, although it's not intuitively obvious, that the precision with which this has to be right is extraordinarily high. The energy, the kinetic energy at the initial explosion of the Big Bang, has to be carefully balanced with the potential energy from gravity to one part in 100,000. And we'll the second one, we'll keep moving ahead here. Stephen Hawking, talking about the energy, okay, says, why is the universe so close to the dividing line between collapsing again and expanding indefinitely? The rate of expansion for 1 second after the Big Bang, if it had been one less by one part in, that should be 10 to the 10th, okay, should have an exponent there, the universe would have collapsed in a few million years. If it had been greater by one part in 10 to the 10th, okay, that would be like 10 trillion, the universe would have been essentially empty. So Stephen Hawking, other people say, you know, there are some initial conditions which when we do the modeling, we say it had to be exactly like this, and the question is why? Wow, that's so, the requirements are so precise, it's hard to imagine.
So we have this absolutely perfect explosion at the beginning that is required, and it would be an explosion such that when all the parts came together, we would have an automobile show up or something. So it would mm-hmm. lead to our next point, and that is just statistical probabilities, right?
Yes. Rare earth is the fifth example that I want to give, and this is actually the title of a book written in about 2000. By two agnostic scientists from the University of Washington in Seattle. And in this book, they go through and they try to enumerate all of the many things that make Earth unique. If you look in our own solar systems, look at all the planets, look at all the moons. You look every place in our solar system and you say there is absolutely no place where there's any realistic probability of life. We look in vain, I think, as we try to find something on Mars. We certainly found the moon wasn't going to have anything. And it's pretty interesting to say, why is it about Earth that it's so different? This is a book that has about 250 pages of what those differences are. It's not a highly technical read. You would really find it extraordinarily interesting. Let me show you what they have to say about this. And this is early in the book. If some godlike beings could be given, notice these guys are agnostics, if some godlike beings could be given the opportunity to plan a sequence of events with the express goal of duplicating our Garden of Eden, that power would face a formidable task. With the best of intentions, but limited by natural laws and materials, it is unlikely that Earth could ever be truly replicated. Too many processes in its formation involve sheer luck. Isn't that a great explanation of how this happened? Sheer luck is our God of the gaps, okay? Earth-like planets could certainly be made, but each would be different in critical ways. And then they go through an amazing journey of all of the things that just had to happen in exactly the way they did. And it's remarkable how easy it would have been to have turned out with a planet that was absolutely inhospitable. Right.
Everything
life.
Has to line up.
Everything
so
has to
you,
line
you
up.
Brought us a video that would show this simple cell is maybe not so simple.
Yes, let's. I think, though, for sake of time, Matt, we maybe should. Well, okay, we'll do.
We'll just watch a few seconds.
This is the origin of life. Yeah, we're going to take this.
Since Kenyon's rejection of chemical evolution, science has revealed the details of an entire system of information processing that bears the hallmarks of intelligent design. With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines...
Okay, we're going to have to cut this short, but this... I want to give you a little bit of a taste of when we talk about the simple cell, the first living organism, it's not simple at all. It's extraordinarily complicated. In the author of the most popular AP biology textbook and the most popular freshman college level book, which is probably maybe the same one, says the following in his section on the origin of life. He says, the largest stumbling block in bridging the gap between living and non-living still remains. All living cells are controlled by information stored in DNA, which is transcribed in RNA, that's what we were just seeing, and then made into protein, which is what was happening as we cut the video off. This is a very complicated system, and each of these three molecules requires the other two, either to put it together or to help it work. DNA, for example, carries information but cannot put that information to use or even copy itself without the help of RNA and proteins. One of the leading atheists in the world, this is a headline from December of 2004. If you were paying attention to the news that day, it was on all the network news. Right. It was in all the newspapers, in some cases headlines from the Associated Press. A British philosophy professor who has been a champion of atheism, this is Anthony Flew, for more than a half century, has changed his mind. He now believes in God more or less because of scientific evidence, and says so on a video that was released on Thursday. At the age of 81, after decades of insisting that belief is a mistake, Anthony Flew has concluded that some sort of intelligence, our first cause, must have created the universe. A superintelligence is the only good explanation for the origin of life and the complexity of nature, Flew said in a telephone interview from England. Amazing. Here's a guy who's probably one of the three most famous atheists of the 20th century. Finally deciding, gosh, with what we're finding today, it's hard to believe that. Now, if you were a young lady driving home at Thanksgiving, you drive into your driveway, you see these trees, and you go, oh my, look at sort of funny way the leaves have fallen off the trees, and you would say, well, gosh, that looks like a face, an image. It actually looks like a girl. And then you look more carefully and say, it looks like me. Now, what are the possible explanations? Is chance an explanation? The answer is it's a possible explanation, but it's not a reasonable possibility. You might think of a loving father, a mischievous brother, a secret admirer. Somebody carefully plucked the leaves off of the tree in a very particular way that would allow it to leave behind an image that looked exactly like you. Obviously, chance is always a possible explanation, but it's not a reasonable explanation. And as we look at the universe, this is exactly the kind of a picture that we see. I think the more we look through the eyes of science, using electron microscopes, which I use every day, telescopes, we see the universe in a way that just brings it to life. And the more we learn, the more amazing it becomes. The heavens do declare the glory of God. The firmament shows forth his handiwork. And science is a way of looking at that in a much more profound way. Rather than rendering belief unnecessary, I think what science has been doing for the last 50 years, and maybe for a longer period than that, is really confirming, really affirming the basis for belief. Let's say intelligent design is not primarily an alternative to evolution. It's an alternative to materialism. It claims that natural processes alone are simply inadequate to explain the complexity and wonder of the natural world. I think today it requires, I've had non-Christian colleagues, 32 of the years I taught, I was in secular schools, and many of my colleagues were non-Christians. They would say, gosh, it takes a lot of faith to be a Christian. And I would say, well, it does take some. But I think it takes a huge amount of faith to be an atheist. And they would always give me this real puzzled look, and then I would invite them to come when I gave talks like this at the schools where I was, and let them see why they really have to have a lot of faith to believe what they do. It requires a tremendous amount of faith.
So what are you saying? What are the odds?
Let's look at the next video and see, okay? Here's a video sort of that illustrates how they respond.
Straight out, flat out, I want you to give me an honest answer. What do you think the chances are of a guy like you and a girl like me ending up together?
Well, Lloyd, that's difficult to say, and we really don't...
Hit me with it! Just give it to me straight! I came a long way just to see you, Mary. Just least you can do is level with me. What are my chances?
Not good.
You mean not good like 1 out of 100?
I'd say more like 1 out of 1,000,000.
So you're telling me there's a chance? Yeah!
You hear that in the labs?
I hear that in the labs. That's the sort of response that I sometimes get from my colleagues. Almost that bad.
Well, listen, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about was here at Grace Covenant Church, this is a flagship verse for us that Christ gave apostles and prophets and evangelists and pastors and teachers to prepare God's people to the work of service, the body of Christ to be built up. I mean, one of the ways we say that is every believer is a minister here. And we believe that sincerely that the reason God gave us gifts like your intelligence and especially expertise in mathematics and science, that that's for the purpose of involving yourself in the kingdom of God outside of your church. The way that God has made you a priest for the world. And one of the reasons you went to Baylor and some other things that you're doing right now, I wanted people to know about how you're expressing the way God made you and the opportunities you've had in the past and how you're projecting that in the present and the future.
Okay. I like to think of the idea that Matt's saying here as being we're all ministers. We just have pulpits with different shapes,
right,
and maybe different locations. But God's called all of us to be ministers. And I'd come to a place in my academic career where I'd really wanted to do something a bit different than what I'd been doing. I'd been making very successfully, working with NASA and Air Force to make high-performance composites and then for offshore oil companies that were interested in using these for oil recovery in deep Gulf of Mexico locations. But these are things that cost $25 a pound. They have very specialized uses. They're never going to help anybody who is really poor and needs basic necessities. And so I thought, God's given me so much opportunity in terms of my professional training and the gifts that he's given me in terms of math and science and in the experience that I've had, that I wanted to use these last 10 years at least of my life to be able to do something that took all of that gift and the stewardship that it implies and use it to do something very direct and very specifically focused on building the kingdom. One of the things that I came to understand through a former PhD student of mine named John Poomwhy, he was the first fellow to ever get his PhD in engineering from Papua New Guinea, first native to ever get a PhD in engineering. Wonderful Christian guy. His parents had become Christians through missionaries there, and the missionaries were the ones that named him John. Okay? Great story. He brought to my attention the plight of poor coconut farmers in Papua New Guinea, but around the world as I looked into it. There are 11 million poor coconut farmers around the world who on average will have families of about this size and live on $500 per year. Can you imagine what kind of a life you could have with that kind of a economic opportunity? The children will never get to go to school because they can't afford the books and the uniforms, even if the education itself is free. And so we will raise generation after generation of these people that don't have any economic opportunity. So our thought was, as we got into this, coconuts are opened up. They take the white meat out. They make coconut oil or sometimes confections for making desserts and stuff. And they throw the shell away. Maybe they burn it for fuel. They throw the husk away. And I thought, gosh, if we could take that agricultural waste, which these coconut farmers own, but which is worth almost nothing, I could get 1,000 coconut husks in Indonesia for $3, and that was the delivery charge. They were picking them up for free at the street. I thought if we could find a way to make these worth something, we could significantly impact the income level of these poor coconut farmers. And so for the last 5 years, I've been working on that project. Here's what a coconut looks like. The part that you're used to seeing is really just the part that is in the center, the white part with the hard nut, but it comes in a husk which protects the coconut as it falls 60 feet to the ground from the coconut tree so it doesn't break open. And it's the husk and the shell that we were wanting to try to give some value to. If you go to places where they make coconut oil around the world, and I've been to about 10 countries where I see huge piles of coconut husks that are sitting there waiting to be burned because there isn't any good application for them. And our goal was to change these, or use these coconut shells and coconut husks to make parts for automotive industry, for the building industry, for children's toys, a whole bunch of different applications, which I'll share with you briefly. We can actually take today, we've successfully figured out how to do this and have patented a way to take the coconut fiber from the husk and combine it with some polypropylene to make a matted material that can then be compression molded into a part for your car. Now, the details aren't important. If you didn't understand anything I just said, it's not a problem. When you open up the trunk of your car, everything that you see in the trunk, we're in the process of making, okay? If you look at your door panels, if you look at your headliner, if you look at the package tray across the back, all of these are made with non-woven fabric composites, which use exclusively oil-based synthetic fibers like polypropylene and polyester. We're simply going to replace 70% of the synthetic with natural fibers. Our product will be cheaper, it will be more environmentally friendly, and it has better properties. And needless to say, we're not having any trouble finding major automotive companies that are extremely interested. And in the next 6 months, we hope that you'll hear a national publicity campaign by one of the automotive companies saying they're now going to be using coconut fiber composites in a bunch of the different parts in their automobiles. We think that this could generate an industry just in automotive that could create as much as $10 million a year worth of income for poor coconut farmers in developing countries. But it could be much bigger than that, because now we've been asked by a bunch of people who are making building materials to say, can you make building materials out of this as well? And the answer is yes, we can make a lot of things out of it. We're also using the coconut shell, finely ground, to be able to use it as a reinforcement in engineering plastics for making children's toys. And we're working with a major children's toy manufacturer who wants to use coconut shell in all of their injection molded parts for their children's toys. And God has just blessed us. There are so many interesting opportunities. When we first started working on this, we thought it's entirely possible that nobody uses this stuff because it really is trash. I mean, it wasn't a given that it had to be worth something. There is some stuff that really just doesn't have properties that are useful. It turns out that coconut shell and coconut fiber have remarkable properties that make it extremely interesting for a wide range of applications. And so our hope and prayer is that in the years to come, that we can really create someplace between $10 and $100 million a year worth of income for poor coconut farmers in developing countries and provide real economic opportunity. Wow. We will do this working very closely with the local indigenous Christians in those particular countries, so that it's done in a way that provides the maximum integration of what I think of is meeting people's material needs with meeting their even greater spiritual needs. If you look at the people who are in the unreached people groups, about 80% of those are in the $2 per day group of people in the world, of which there's about 2.7 billion. And so we think this is a wonderful way to try to do something God's told us to do, to go to lovingly care for the poor and those who have less, as Jesus said in Matthew 25, and at the same time provide a platform as we love them by meeting these kinds of basic needs to be able to also share the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's really hard to go to people who are desperately poor and say God loves you and cares about you, but then do nothing to help be a manifestation of that.
Mm-hmm. You must feel like for such a time as this that you're in the right place at the right time, and God gave you these abilities and meet these people to allow this to happen.
I look at my whole life's history and think of all the things that I've done that have prepared me to be able to do exactly this job.
Right.
I could have been in something other than composite materials, and I'll tell you, there's a lot of agricultural trash around the world, and by God's grace, we're going to make a lot of it worth a lot of money, okay?
Right.
So we can help poor people everywhere. Well, there have been a bunch of other fun projects we've gotten involved in as I've been at Baylor. This is a bridge, and people often say, well, what does it mean to do Christian engineering? I mean, a bridge is a bridge. You know, a non-Christian bridge looks just like a Christian bridge. And I will say, well, not always, okay? What makes this a Christian bridge is it's 20 miles from the nearest road in the middle of nowhere, where there are people on the far side of a river that's about 150 feet wide that has crocodiles and hippos in it. And these people can't access health care, education, or get to market without walking 20 miles. And so we went and partnered with a bunch of Christians there to design the bridge and then to help build it. It turns out that maybe half the people in the village are Christians. They are just Christians that are desperately needy. And when we built the bridge, they had a wonderful celebration with prayers of dedication and so forth. And it was a very special experience. This bridge will save the people on the far side of the river 2 million miles worth of walking per year. Okay? And if the bridge lasts 10 years, it'll be a really good buy in transportation, right? Here's one more example, and then we'll wrap up. People in Armenia often are so poor that they live in discarded shipping containers. That's what this is, as houses. Just metal walls, some kind of a cheap floor, and then whatever the roofing on the shipping container was. And the weather here is like North Dakota in the wintertime. It gets down to minus 30. And many of these people freeze to death in the winter, especially children. And so what we've done is to help develop some new foam building blocks that look like great big Lego blocks. And the Lego blocks can easily be stacked, and then we have some rebar and pour some columns of concrete. They're like Lego blocks, but with holes on the little round parts that insert to put it together. And We can build a concrete foam house like this. The whole walls on this thing can be built in about a day, and the cost of that part of the house is only about $2,000. It has an R value, for those of you who do building materials, of about 30, which is really superb. People say, well, you don't want a house made out of styrofoam, do you? And the answer is yes. It's got great insulating properties. It's very inexpensive. It's very lightweight. We can have children doing the building. I mean, this is a great product. It's now being used in 6 or 7 different countries around the world. But the Armenian government has actually asked the people that we were working with in country to start building houses for them because they're so economical, they're so energy efficient. Let's skip this. We've got too many stories
kind of
here.
Out of time.
Okay.
Dr. Bradley, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. It's been a privilege to be here. Oh, wait, Matt, we were going to tell him one more thing about what if you're not an engineer.
Right. Sure. If you're not an engineer, what do you do?
Yeah, somebody says, well, this is great, but I'm not an engineer. Well, I've got two friends who are doing something really cool, and they're in title insurance. Now, you might think title insurance, how could that be used to serve the kingdom of God? And what they discovered was, as they were going on overseas missions trips in many poor parts of the world, people don't own title to their land. And so they don't build much on it because they fear that if they build something nicer on it, somebody will come take it from them. And so they've started programs, one for a whole country in Africa and the other in Dominican Republic, where they're actually helping poor people develop title insurance, not title insurance, but titles, so they will actually own their land and so people can't come and take it away from them at some point in the future. And it is a wonderful ministry for poor people in these developing countries. And I'm thinking, if God can use people who do engineering and God can use people who do title insurance, God can surely use many of you if you'll ask him to help you think outside the box. There are probably amazing things that you can do either here or overseas.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But, guys, I just want you to leave today knowing that it requires a certain amount of faith to believe that God created the heavens and the earth, like it says in Hebrews chapter 11. But God is a reckless creator. He leaves his fingerprints and evidence all over. And whatever your discipline might be, the students here in high school and junior high and the college students that have returned, maybe or that are here for the last week of school, you can know that your faith isn't being violated in the classroom. It actually should be being reinforced. The other thing is that no matter where you are and how God's made you and the experiences you've had, you could be using that for the kingdom of God all over the world. And maybe even in our closing prayer here before our offertory, we could just be thinking about how God might use us. And maybe, you know, right now, especially if you're younger, maybe the way God's using you right now is preparing you for the future. Dr. Bradley spent 35 years to get to this sweet spot. Sometimes it takes that. If you just obey God's will where you are and enjoy the way he's made you to do the things he's called you to do. Let's close our time in a word of prayer, and we'll have one more song. Dear Heavenly Father, we are grateful for men like Dr. Bradley and the way you've inspired him, and I'd ask that you would do the same in our lives, that you give us meaning and purpose and direction and a vision for what we could do for poor people around the world or the poor person down the street, the person that doesn't know you, the person that knows you and doubts whether they should because of the, I guess, debate that goes along in their mind. God, I'd ask that you would inspire us by today's time to be thinking and faith-filled followers of Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name, amen.
For more information about Grace, visit our website at grace360.org.